Welcome to the Children's Law Podcast, brought to you by True North Child Advocates, where we believe that advocacy is the answer. Hey, everybody, this is Angela, and I'm in West Palm Beach with John, Jim, and Bill. And today we're going to talk about avoiding landmines on the road to permanency.
Yeah, and let's start with probably the biggest landmine that everyone faces in this practice. It's the law that puts the needs of the states over the needs of the child and the family. And that, of course, would be the Interstate Compact on the Placement of Children, ICPC. For our new listeners or our law students out there, that is the statute or the interstate agreement that provides that a child may not enter another state until there's been a home study done on the placement in that state that you want the child to go into. So this can be a six-month process, okay?
Or more.
I've seen it take a year for children to simply cross a state line to get to their relative, their grandmother, sometimes their non-offending parent, which raises all kinds of constitutional issues, which for some reason no one has ever challenged. But anyway, what we want to give you today is just some quick and dirty ideas on how to get over some of the landmines we're going to talk about. Now, with the Interstate Compact, one thing that we have found works is if you actually make a phone call to the receiving state to talk to the social worker in that state who's doing the home study. Now, you will very often be treated like you violated one of the Ten Commandments when you do this, okay? Like it's a cardinal sin. We're not supposed to pick up the phone and call another person in another state. What are you doing? We're not supposed to talk to each other. That's not true. You can make that phone call. I have found that maybe one time out of 10, I get a human being on the other end of the line that actually wants to talk about what's best for this family, what's best for this child. Yeah, I can get out there next week and do the home study for you, and then I'll ship it off to the state capitol real quick. And, you know, it's positive. So you can let your court know it's positive. You can let your client know it's positive that they're going to be going. That's one quick and dirty solution. Like I said, happens one in every 10 times if you're lucky. Another solution is to have the placement in the receiving state. Let's say grandma. Have her call her local representative and see if that representative's office will call the state agency in the receiving state and put some pressure on them to get the home study done quicker. That is something that state agencies tend to respond to. Having represented a state agency, I can tell you the two things they really care about are pressure from a political agency, a political representative, or pressure from the media. That's pretty much what they respond to. I'm not trying to badmouth the people who work for the agencies. I'm talking about the bureaucracies. Bureaucracies tend to respond to political pressure or media pressure. It's a very strange thing, but that's just the nature of bureaucracy. Anyway, so that's the Interstate Compact. A couple of quick solutions for you.
But also best interest, too. Isn't there
an argument there?
You know, there is some case law out there that the best interest of the child is what prevails over the state's need to comply with the Interstate Compact. It's fact-specific case law, but if you look into it, it's something you can use in the right facts that this child has to go and has to go now. You're going to run into all sorts of problems with the Interstate Compact, and we could spend probably a whole hour on it, and probably will at some point. There are some states that require a relative to become licensed, which is a three-month process to get your license. They're doing that for all sorts of potentially nefarious financial reasons. Why relatives need to be licensed and become 4E eligible, I don't know. But, you know, like I said, we can have a talk on that. But there is best interest case law out there that might be able to override the ICPC. So look at it. It's a Florida case, and there are some cases from other states as well, I think. Another common landmine we want to talk about today is the case of the missing father. If your jurisdiction is anything like my jurisdiction, you may have a statute that requires that an inquiry be done when one of the parents is missing. An inquiry of the mother generally as to who the father is and where he is. And also if your jurisdiction is anything like my jurisdiction, that statute is rarely followed. Nobody does that inquiry. Instead, some judge or somebody informally asks, hey, who's the dad? And so mom gives the name, or who could be the dad? And mom gives the name of Fred. And so we all go on our merry way looking for Fred, or the agency does anyhow, which takes some time because mom doesn't know where Fred is and hasn't seen him in a long time. So the case proceeds. The mother gets her case plan. The clock is ticking on our client because we're trying to get our child to permanency within a year. And we get the mother adjudicated dependent, or the child adjudicated as to the mother. We get the case plan approved. And yet dad is lingering. Even on a good case with a missing father, you're looking at taking some time to find this guy. Well, Fred either doesn't appear or does appear and turns out not to be dad. Invariably, mom will pivot and say, well, then it's probably Barney. And so the agency will just pivot with a sense of great responsibility to find Barney. And your client's case is now starting to go officially adrift, because the worst thing that can happen now, probably, is that Barney shows up and is the dad and is worthless as a parent. That's the problem. If Barney shows up and he's a great guy, fantastic. The odds of that happening, in my experience, are slim.
Right, because where has Barney been and why was he second choice? He's obviously not very involved.
Right. For God's sake, she thought Fred was a better choice than Barney, and we couldn't even find Fred. So now we've got Barney and we're in trouble. So this is something, the best way to avoid it is to just be diligent from the outset and be as diligent about serving that second parent as they were about serving that first parent. Act like your case has not gone forward, or at least in your mind. Pretend that your case has not gone forward because there's still a father out there. The problem is that these cases do go to case plan, get set for judicial review, and go on in the chronological order they're supposed to. But it's kind of a fiction because there's an unserved parent. So you could get all the way to termination of parental rights, as most of the listeners with experience out there know, and you're tripped up by this father out there whose rights have not been protected. So try to get on it as fast as you possibly can. It's an agency issue. It's not easy to move.
But if it's the agency's issue, what's the children's lawyer's role in getting it done?
Well, it's the agency's issue, but it's your problem because it's your client's problem. So your role is really to get it done and to conduct the inquiry in court to make sure it's done correctly. And finally, I like to, in the ideal circumstances, get the parent, the mother, under oath in court and even say, Judge, I want us to ask this question one time. And here's the inquiry, and let's go down it. Did you live with any man on or about the time this child was conceived? You know, these are the questions we have in Florida. Has any man supported this child? Has any man signed the birth certificate? Were you married to any man? These are the questions we have in Florida. Other jurisdictions may have similar statutes or no statutes on this. But the point is, it's not the children's lawyer's duty, but it's our problem. So it becomes our role, part of our role.
And isn't that, as you talk about dads coming late to the party, don't we have the exact same problem with relatives?
Oh, we sure do. Yes. Yeah. And here's why it's a problem, is because your client may get placed in a foster home and may spend 7, 8, 10, 12 months in that foster home. And, you know, that may not seem like a long time to us grown-ups, but for the child, that may constitute 80% of their life, 100% of their life. Maybe 50% of their life, but the best 50% of their life, right? Maybe they've identified this as mom and dad now. They're going to school. They have foster siblings who are like brothers and sisters to them. They're planning on, in their mind, maybe this is where they're going to be because mom and dad are not complying with their case plan, and you think this case is going adoption, perhaps. Well, now out of the, and this happens very frequently, right, is birth parents, and you can't necessarily blame the relatives, but birth parents will sometimes not reach out or reveal relatives until they see they're staring down the barrel of losing their parental rights to their child. And then they will reach out to relatives, particularly in other states, who may not know what's going on with them. Maybe they've kind of cut ties with this family a while ago, right? But they reach out to them and say, hey, Susan's in foster care. Oh, how long has she been in foster care? Oh, about a year. Those conversations happen, and so now here comes the relative from out of state. They want a home study. Well, now it's hard for your client, right? Because your client, it would have been so much better for those relatives, for everyone involved, if that home study could be done sooner in the process. This is a really tough one to troubleshoot because the parents won't always want to reveal who's out there. But if there's a relative out of state that might be considered as a placement option, we need to at least inquire. Everyone has known living relatives, pretty much. And one way to search it is to get mom's date of birth and information and dad's date of birth information. And sometimes you can plug it into Ancestry.com and the family tree will populate a little bit just based on public records. You know, not going back generations, but you don't need that. That's not, you know, but if you can just grab the next generation up and the siblings over, that's a great start.
Right. And there's tools like Accurant that can search pretty exhaustively throughout the states using clues like previous known addresses and things like that. And you can dig up the aunts and uncles and of and your clients.
Can you be more specific about it? So that is that an app or a website that you're talking about?
It's a search engine, I believe. You do pay a monthly subscription for it. We do it in our office. But it's made a difference in that we have been able to reach out and find relatives, locate missing fathers, things like that, that are technically outside of our role, but it's our client's issue.
Doesn't this become, though, I can hear the judges screaming on these issues, because when the grandparent shows up a year later, you want the grandparent to be considered, but it has now derailed everything you've been working on to get this kid's stable, and now it's unstable, but yet it's the grandparent. I just hear judges screaming and getting upset and feeling the need to have the grandparent investigated because it's a blood relative, but yet at the same time we're derailing a plan. Do you know what I mean? There's so much frustration in this.
There is, and that's what, for judges especially, this should be like important, because they're the ones now that have to make the incredibly difficult decision. I mean, grandma didn't do anything wrong, right? She didn't know her grandchild maybe was in foster care, and maybe she couldn't stay in touch. So what's her sin? Living in another state so she doesn't get to raise her grandchild? But you're the judge, and psychologically, the foster parents are maybe this baby's birth. If the baby came home from the hospital to the foster home, psychologically, that's his home. Other than the broken cord, this child has never had any loss, has never lost a primary caregiver. So the judge is in this really difficult King Solomon-like decision role that they don't want to be in, you know. So that's why if you get knowledge of the grandmother earlier, then you can say, even if you're out of state and I don't want to send the kid out of state, okay, grandma, but if you're thinking of placement, you better start visiting, you better come down here and visit, you know, come down and see the child. We can let foster parent know this is where we might be going. Everyone's expectations can be tempered, and including the child's, right, by exposing them to grandma. It saves everyone from that really difficult situation later on.
And that's a difficult situation for the attorney. I mean, you can see yourself saying, gosh, it is a biological relative.
I've been in that situation. And the only guiding principle that I turn to is, you know, if my client has never suffered the trauma of separation from a primary caregiver, then I tend to say first, do no harm.
Right.
And I tend to say, leave the child with their primary caregiver, even if it's not the blood relative. And I know that will not be popular with everyone, but there is no great solution on those cases. And it does come down to case by case. And, you know, what's the connection?
Isn't what we're saying, though, that we have to, in every case, create this sense of urgency at the beginning? And it's, you know, there's so much happening, and you might, you're like, great, they're in this wonderful foster home. But if you don't really look at every case with this potential outcome in mind, with the idea that someone could come in late, any case could get derailed, and that assuming the parent isn't able to get the child back.
Yes, yes. It's our job to convey the sense of urgency to everyone, and again, to be in the driver's seat, and to also tap the brakes occasionally, like when they give us home studies, particularly home studies that suck. Okay, some home studies, if you read them, are not very thorough. This might seem overwhelming in some jurisdictions, but reading the home studies of potential placements for your clients is a very simple, elementary, but critical task. We have had children die in relative and non-relative placements because of the urgency the state has to empty the foster care beds from time to time, right? They get overcrowded. The budget is starting to sink. The ship is listing to one side. What are we going to do? Let's get some people on lifeboats. Boom, 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 boom. And they do it too quickly, and they overlook things. And this, it, it's just a critical read of a home study document. And once you've done it a few times, you'll know exactly what pages you need to turn to look for the critical information. Like, are there any frequent visitors to the home? Have they been background checked? You know, have even the custodians been background checked, right? And sometimes it's right there. It's like, yes, they've been background checked. Here's their abuse history. It's approved. Wait, you're approving this placement. Look at this abuse history. Very often it's just telling the judge, look what they filed. This isn't an approved home study. You don't want to put the child with this person, do you? And you can save children's lives. You can save them from further abuse and neglect. And here's the other thing, just in terms of permanency, you can save the problem of now the case doesn't end up in reunification, and these people in no way, shape, or form will ever be approved to adopt the child. That's another big problem. So it does come into concurrent planning, and permanency-focused advocacy is reading that initial placement home study.
It's one of the things, like we're talking about with the late-to-the-party fathers and relatives, it's one of the things that's front-loaded in the start of the case that makes the end of the case so much easier. If you do these things up front, you'll be glad. The judge will be very glad.
Your client will be very glad.
Your client will be very glad. It's a much more seamless journey for the client. The home studies, you're not really looking to make your own value judgment on the home. You're looking for the glaring errors, and you will see remarks like, there are guns in the home. They're stored in the closet. Okay. That home study approved. I said shotguns in a closet is not acceptable. They're supposed to be locked in a cabinet by their own administrative rule. But that's the kind of thing you'll see in home studies. You're looking for those glaring errors, the frequent visitors.
And the unlisted frequent visitors too. I mean, I read it critically, right? I mean, if it's a single woman and she has, you know, 2-3 children of her own, and she's taking your client into her home as an aunt or something, then just ask yourself the question, you know, does she have a partner? Does she have a boyfriend or a girlfriend? And should we be, well, then that person's going to be a frequent visitor in this day and age, right? I mean, I've actually had people tell me, yes, she has a boyfriend, but he doesn't come to the home. And I said to myself, and one time they said he comes to the home, but not when the children are around. Okay, and I'm saying to myself, well, that's a red flag. Why are you telling it to me in that way? Why can't he be around my client? Oh, but you don't want to background check him. So I have, you know, you have to ask yourself these questions.
But I also think there's a flip side too. You may get a home study that declines a home that your client has said, oh, I want to be there. Or there's another reason for you to think that this is an appropriate placement. And so that's another way to read the home study. Why are they declining? Do you know? And when this actually is could be the home for the child.
Yeah, I would say the agency can misread it on the other way too, in terms of risk level. It's like, wait, that those situations don't present a risk to my client. Yeah, they're poor. There's not a lot of money. But they're going to get relative caregiver money if they take my client. So, you know, there's no risk to my client's safety. My client would rather be with her family that she knows and loves. Yeah. And if they don't have enough money to go around at the end of the month, they'll survive. We'll get them resources. You know, the connection is more important. So, yeah, you have to watch for a misread by the agency on the other end as well.
And as you kind of look back over the things that we've talked about today, we always bear in mind workload for people. And I think that if you look at all of these, what we're really talking about is focusing your work on the most important piece, which is where that child is going to live from the very beginning. And what are all the possibilities and what are the steps that we need to take that will, it may take more work now reading that home study, but you could save, it's a landmine. You could save yourself from going off on a completely different track down the road, which is going to cost you much more time in your caseload.
The point is to get the child out of foster care as quickly as possible. And these are things that can derail any plan to get the child home to a permanent placement. And so we have to look at these things. We have to help when maybe we don't want to. We have to push for the sake and betterment of our client.
I think that's a great place to wrap up. Thank you so much for joining us. You've been listening to the Children's Law Podcast, brought to you by True North Child Advocates. Please take a moment to subscribe and spread the word. Thank you.